Welcome back for another episode of The Short Code, a podcast of wit and wisdom from the medical students at the University of Iowa Carver College of Medicine. I'm executive producer Dave Etler. Recently, the University of Iowa was lucky enough to get a visit from Dr. Paul Farmer. Farmer, a medical anthropologist and physician, is a founding director of Partners in Health, an international nonprofit organization that provides direct healthcare services and has undertaken research and advocacy activities on behalf of those who are sick and living in poverty. Dr. Farmer is the chair of the Department of Global Health and Social Medicine at the Harvard University Medical School, chief of the Division of Global Health Equity at Brigham and Women's Hospital, and the United Nations Deputy Special Envoy for Haiti under Special Envoy Bill Clinton. Farmer and his colleagues in the United States and in Haiti, Peru, Russia, Rwanda, Lesotho, and Malawi have pioneered novel community-based treatment strategies that demonstrate the delivery of high-quality healthcare in resource-poor settings. The medical students were able to get some time with Dr. Farmer for a little Q&A on the challenges he and Partners in Health face when working in such settings.
Thank you very much. And thank you all for turning out. This is a nice crowd, big crowd. I do, however, deserve it. Not for the reasons Greg mentioned, but to get from Rwanda to Iowa City is quite an endeavor, especially if you travel as I did via Haiti. So don't ask me or I'll be glad to lay out for you the 11 segments to that flight, if you'd like. Instead, what I really want to do is just mention a couple of things, and just for 2 minutes, 3 minutes, which, of course, if you're a professor, means 2 to 3 times 1.7.42 or something. In other words, it'll be longer than 2 or 3 minutes. It already is. I'm going to open this up by mentioning, tonight I'm going to talk about the earthquake in Haiti. Some of the people in this room, faculty, students, many of you participated in responding to the earthquake in one way or another, either from here or actually going to Haiti. I know that, and I'm grateful for it. And I'll have more of a chance to talk about the earthquake tonight, but I will say here in front of medical students that it was a very difficult and humbling experience to realize the limits of expertise. A lot of what I did after the quake was try and bring surgical capacity to Haiti, trauma, orthopedics, et cetera, and open up field hospitals. Of course, the hospitals that we had built, to which Greg made reference, were still standing. They weren't in the earthquake zone, so there's a lot of work in those hospitals. That's about 10 hospitals. But inside the earthquake zone, a lot of what we did was try and organize teams to respond more effectively to what was really a lot of trauma. And again, some of you are part of that. But what I want to say here is it's a very difficult experience. It was hard on the medical staff. It was obviously hardest on the victims and their whether they survived or not, the families affected by the quake. They're the ones who had it hardest. But it was very difficult, I think, for the doctors and nurses and other frontline providers. And one of the reasons that I wrote this book that was tied to some extent to my invitation here, which is called Haiti After the Earthquake, was really to just try and set some of this down. What is it that we try to do in the immediate months after the earthquake, and what's left to do still? What was left to do even before the quake? So that's something I'd be happy to talk about in our discussion here today. The other is, I know many of you are interested in health equity and health disparities. And the reason that we use this term a lot, first of all, I still agree. I don't know where you got that. Equity is the only acceptable goal. But I'm sure I've said it a million times and probably written it about 2 million times. And I still believe it is the only right goal for medicine. It's the only way we keep ourselves out of trouble is to have that as a goal. That doesn't mean that you can by fiat say, gee, you know, we have to have an equity plan with every new medical development. It would be a good thing to do, though, if we had time and energy to do it. And I know a lot of you are interested in this question of equity. How do we use the fruits of science? Because a lot of modern medicine really comes out of the lab. How do we use the fruits of science equitably? It's a big problem for 21st century medicine and a good problem for us to have. You know, just 50, 60 years ago, a lot of what we would regard as the core of biomedicine really wasn't available. And I feel, and I'm sure you do too, that new discoveries are just coming online every day for diagnostics, preventives like vaccines, and also therapeutics. So that's an exciting time to be a medical student, I think. And regardless of what area of medicine you go into, it's a very exciting time. And I think it's going to be a good ride for the next few years in terms of, again, the tools we have at our disposal. Having an equity plan is a big deal. And that's true whether you're working in a city in the United States or, a rural area or Rwanda or Haiti. It's really true everywhere. So those are the two things I wanted to say. To add to the second point about health equity, a lot of what our group has done has been, in the old days would have been referred to as international health. It's not a good term. It's got international health is not as descriptive as global health equity, because that's a reminder that every place, including Iowa City, is on the globe. Even Ames, Iowa, is on the globe. I could work that tonight, couldn't I? In the big auditorium. I sat next to a Hawkeye on the plane. I imagine that wasn't hard to do statistically, since there are 30,000 of you. But he encouraged me to work the cyclones into my talk tonight. But the programs that we've set up at Harvard in global health equity span the entire university, from the 18-year-olds who come in as freshmen, most of them 18, to the junior faculty and of course the senior faculty. So that means we have programs for undergraduates, for medical students, for graduate students in other departments. we have support for junior faculty. At the same time, we can't do this work without acknowledging that for every American medical student, there is a Haitian or a Rwandan or a Basutu or a Russian. That is, global health has to work both ways. So that's a very... Is there any water, or is that like not permitted here in this watery city?
I have a question.
Yeah.
So how do you determine how much aid to give in relative to what their economic development?
Who, the people in Iowa?
Well, your Rwanda, anywhere, economic development. You know, you kind of need that first, and then. Okay.
You know, this is a really a troubling question, not in the sense of you launching it to me, but something we struggle with every day. Some generous person gave me their $4 bottle of Fiji water.
Compared to Ivy.
Well, Ivy may be next. I think to put it in a slightly different, the question in a different form, the way I'll just share with you what I think about it, because I do think about this all the time. Is when you say, for example, Rwanda 2005. I won't have a chance to talk about that tonight, so I'll mention it here. In 2005, Partners in Health, with a pretty big retinue of people, went to Rwanda at the invitation of the Rwandan government and working with the Clinton Foundation. And of course, we did what we always do, which is find local partners, women's groups, church groups, whatever. And we went into an area of Rwanda that had been greatly disrupted by the genocide. It is estimated that about 60% of the people living there in this area were displaced. How many of you have been to Rwanda? So some few of you. This is in southeastern Rwanda, and not too far from the border with Tanzania. And we had these discussions. With the same questions were asked by Rwandans too. How do you know? They didn't say how do you know how much aid to give them or us, but rather where do you make your investments? And I hadn't really worked with many economists before. We ended up bringing in a full-time economist who had been working with Jeff Sachs, or trained with Jeff Sachs at Columbia University, and was living in Rwanda. And so he's studying that question in a very different way. What he said is not the way you said it, or which is not unlike what I've heard from many, is how do you spring the poverty trap? How do you get people out of the poverty trap? Which was a good way of asking it. The way we've been saying is, when you're trying to break a cycle of poverty and disease, where do you make the investments? And what I saw that first year, which really startled me, was we saw so many people dying of malaria in 2005. We had staff die of malaria. We had patients coming in every day dropping dead of malaria. We had children with, you know, cerebral malaria or disseminated malaria. And what was clear in 2005 was one of the answers to that question, how much, was, well, make sure you do enough to get rid of the malaria so that they can work, because the problem, as you said, is really poverty. And the way to the Rwandans are trying to do this is to build their economy and also their tax base, because, you know, with I've told not to go to Iowa and talk about taxes. That's left for another crowd of people who will be upon you all too soon, and I don't mean the Hawkeye football players. But we know that doctors who do this kind of work, nurses, I said, clinicians, we all know that it's really poverty driving the problem. So responding to poverty is a big part of the question. But how do you do that? When everybody's sick with malaria, I gave you that example because it was dramatic to me. After 2005, I've been doing this for 20-something years, quarter of a century. And we knew that part of the answer was investing in healthcare and education. Invest in healthcare, education, gender equity. What does that mean? Make sure that girls are in school. You know, and then if you could make sure that the kids had a hot meal or a meal of any sort in school, that would be a death blow to all kinds of illnesses. So what we say in answer to your question is, how do you know how much is enough? Well, people like the economist Jeff Sachs have actually tried to answer that around healthcare and came up with a figure a little bit lower than I would have imagined. But he's, you know, this is a serious commission on macroeconomics. And they said, really, for $37 per capita investment, you could, you know, again, deal a death blow to a lot of the problems that we see now. Now, that's a very tiny amount of money. In Massachusetts, the average expenditures, these are expenditures, I think is pushing 8,000. Is that right, Emily? My colleague, Emily Bonson. I think it's $8,000 per person per year, $6,000 more nationally, 16% of our GDP. Huge amount of money going into healthcare. And it, people can ask, is this money being spent wisely? Is it saving lives, preventing illness? Is it too much and too poorly spent? Again, that's a debate for other experts, although I have my opinions. But I think 37 is too small, and 8,000's got a lot of waste in it. So that gives us a huge, you know, margin. My guess is we're probably spending in our work, which attempts to break the cycle of poverty and disease with some investments in healthcare and education. We're also working with people involved in agricultural development, access to microcredit, we're even trying to train university level people. Medical school started a residency program last week in Haiti, this week in Haiti on Tuesday, or a week ago, launched a family practice residency. Those are very expensive investments, but no one would question their wisdom, you know, in a place like Iowa City or Boston. You know, you need these kind of programs. And we're trying to move them into Haiti, too. So that's a very long answer to a really sharp and good question. But I think the concise answer is going to be, if we have to choose between direct investments in an economy and healthcare or and education, choose between all those infrastructure like roads, we're going to be in trouble. Because really, to break that cycle of poverty and disease, you need lots of investments going on at the same time. That said, I'm very confident it can be done, even in Haiti, which is had a tough go of it. Thank you. And if any of you is an economist and wants to work on this full time, are you a med student?
Yeah.
If any of you is an economist and wants to work on this full time, I think it's going to be, people will be asking these questions forever, and we need better, refined, and shorter answers. Yeah. Please. You know what? It would be great if you'd introduce yourselves. So, what's your name?
Jeffrey
Bobel. Jeffrey.
Mbechi.
Mbechi.
So often you hear talks about economic development. You also hear HIV. And my question is actually whether or not we can begin to consider HIV-1 as a chronic illness in the developing world.
Yeah.
But also whether we can, I don't know if now is the time to begin thinking that might not be so acute, like malaria or, again, HIV. I know, like, the Baylor International Pediatric AIDS Initiative is now shifting toward this more global health approach.
Yeah.
Well,
my take would be kind of generous, because if you look at again, another terrific question, and you guys are getting at the hard stuff, you know, no softballs from the Hawkeyes. When Baylor started that program, they started what's called a vertical program, right? So a vertical program is something that focuses on one problem. Now, in clinical medicine, the kind of medicine most of you will practice, there'll be significant amount of vertical programs. Someone who's going to be a cardiac surgeon is really going to just do cardiac surgery, right? Someone who does a lot of, some people will do endoscopy, you know, all that. I'm smiling because I just thought I was on in the hospital at Harvard in the Brigham, where I work, and I was in the hallway and I couldn't see these people talking. One of them is a pulmonologist, and the other is a gastroenterologist. And the pulmonologist has a loud voice that carries, and I heard her saying, "Well, Frank, if you didn't like stool, you shouldn't have gone into GI." But so there is humor in medicine as well. But these are all vertical programs. Like, the GI people do endoscopy, you know, and the cardiac surgery people do cardiac surgery. Some of you will do more integrated work, like even in family practice, but certainly in, you know, family practice focused on primary care, pediatrics, primary care psychiatry. There's a lot of, and then there's some of you who do public health, which is, you know, attempts to be integrated. But going back to, to global health, when Baylor started that program, if you went to Swaziland, or if you go to Swaziland, where one of the places that one of my former students was working with them, he's a pediatrician. I don't know where Mary went. Mary knows some people in Mozambique, the guy I'm talking about, and actually met a number of people working on that program. They eventually became frustrated because it was so vertical, right? The young pediatricians, most of them from the United States, working there, they would say, well, you know, kids have other problems besides HIV, but you go to Swaziland, this is the ranking cause of pediatric death number one in the country, and in Lesotho, and all over parts of Southern Africa. You said we hear about HIV. You didn't hear me mention it, because actually, HIV doesn't really loom that large in the work I do in Haiti or Rwanda, because even though it did become the leading infectious killer of young adults in those two countries, and a leading killer of kids, if not the leading killer of kids, there are many other things going on at the same time. So we were always building, as partners in health, integrated primary care programs, whereas Baylor was doing a vertical program. I think they're both good and they're both necessary, but if you have vertical programs, you really do have to have partners who are going to be thinking not only, back to Jeffrey's point about breaking the cycle of poverty and disease, but also about the other healthcare problems, from major mental illness to acute MI. I was just talking to one of your faculty about a visitor that we had in central Haiti, an American, who had an acute MI while he was visiting us. These things happen. You know, that's the way God created humans. We have all kinds of problems. So, regardless of what you do or I do, if we have vertical programs, if we do our own thing, that could be fine. I mean, I would love to have, you know, neurosurgeons working with us in Haiti. I don't want them to go and tell us how to do drug procurement or do home visits, you know, with the community health workers. I want them to be in the operating room opening up people's skulls, right? That's what they do. So I think, regardless of what we do need these platforms. And in the last few years, in this period of time you've been talking about, this very ungainly language of health system strengthening was born. And it's ungainly language, but it describes what we really need to do. And that's true whether you're doing short-term medical missions, which a number of people at this university and in this area do, which is a great thing, right? Short-term medical mission depends on what you're delivering, right? Is it the best way to do a vaccination program? No. Is it the best way to deliver primary care? Uh-uh. Is it the best way to deliver mental health services? Certainly not. Pretty good way to deal with elective surgical problems, though. And if you can link that to health system strengthening, these vertical endeavors, whether you're talking about cleft palate repair, you know, there are a lot of groups that do cleft palate repair. And it's easy. It's not easy for me. You wouldn't want me to try and do it. But it's very vertical. It's neat and clean. They can pack up their stuff. They train the teams. But imagine if they link that, the people who do this, mostly Americans, some Europeans, if they link that to strengthening surgical services writ large, including obstructed labor, C-section. And, you know, that's what we're trying to pull our friends in various fields of medicine, our colleagues and friends, into doing their bit the best they can with the time and resources they have and linking that to health system strengthening. So back to your question, you guys are thinking, but we thought he was done. I'll just say one thing. Chronicity, back to your words, chronicity and acuity are really probably the most important terms there, not pathology X like HIV or pathology Y like malaria. It's really acuity and chronicity. You need to, health systems that can take care of acute problems, you know, a fracture, road trauma, and also chronic disease, diabetes, AIDS, major mental illness, complications of coronary artery disease, hypertension. When you can build systems, again, whether in Iowa or in rural Haiti, build systems that can manage these effectively and with the tools of science, I think we're going to be making a lot of progress. And I do think, back to Jeffrey's point again, that we're going to be able to see the impact of these investments on breaking that cycle of poverty and disease as well. I think it's harder in the United States because there have been such large expenditures than it is in rural Africa, because you see people dying so young and you say to them, stop dying already here. And they stop dying. They really do. It's very gratifying work. Does that help?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So my name is Edward Chuck, and I have a question about, I guess, so for many, so for all U.S., I guess, medical or physicians, we have this really great, fortunate, I guess, opportunity to learn the best medical education possible. Then we have all these physicians now going abroad, but the way we trained has best facility, best everything, and resources. Now when we go to these developing countries, you know, the medical physician, local medical physician, they are trained under limited resources, and then that creates a lot of clashes between Western and Western.
Rich world.
Yes. So I guess, like, so since working as an international health partners, like if there was any problems, then how you track all that, and then what happened?
Well, it sounds like you're speaking from experience, and I have had the same experience, of course. And I think there are other people here on the faculty as well who've had the same experience. This was another very difficult thing about the earthquake. Again, I haven't talked very much about this publicly because it's not a very comfortable situation. But most of the 99% of the people that Partners in Health works with in Haiti are Haitian. And they live and work there, and that's, and I've been working with some of them. We've been working with some of them for over 20 years. The arrival on the scene, and where did Greg go? There he is. I want you to hear this because you're part of my plan to fix this. The arrival on the scene of the diaspora, not your generation, but your parents' generation, caused a lot of clashes that were not related to culture and language, right? They were really related to what you said. They were Haitian Americans and Haitian Canadians and Haitian Europeans and Haitians. And they didn't need any interlocutors to have a fight. They didn't need anybody to translate for them to have their arguments. It was really uncomfortable, actually. And it was, and I was pulled into it a couple of times. This doesn't surprise you, I'll bet. I was pulled into it more than a couple of times. I have been over the years many times. And I don't have a short answer for that question either. But I do think that part of the answer is to pull the quality of the training and infrastructure up in places like Haiti. You know, because what you describe is true now. You know, we're training the best medical centers. The medical center here, I looked at the numbers on the plane on the way here. I was sitting next to a guy who works in the medical school, and he happened to have all the data. I didn't show you this, Emily, but he had all the data about how many beds there are in the hospital, how many outpatients visits, how many pharmacy prescriptions are written. I have all these numbers still lodged in my head. So we're training in that environment, thank God, right? Because it's a good place to train. You know, the floors are clean, nobody comes in late for rounds, or if they do, there's enough peer pressure to cripple them for a few weeks. You know, there are 2,000 nurses here, affiliated, 2,000. I mean, for a city this size, there's a huge, there's 700 trainees in residency and fellowship programs. It's a huge medical center in a fairly small city. Can we build that in the middle of central Haiti? Probably not. But can we build a proper teaching hospital with enough room to have better teaching, especially for the Haitians, our primary concern in Haiti, as Rwandans are in Rwanda and Russians are in Russia, et cetera? And I think the answer to that is yes. And that's part of it. So if we go in and we diagnose and say, okay, we have this great medical infrastructure, we're training the best, but we're not trained to work in this crappy infrastructure. You didn't say crappy, but you know, in scholarly terms, that's what we'd say. And I'm saying part of the answer has to be, all right, already with the crappy infrastructure. Let's, you know, level a few more of these hospitals and rebuild them properly. And it's not going to be quick, although tonight I'll show you. You are coming tonight, aren't you? I'll watch. Hollister, Div 22. I'll see if you're there. Mr. Dr. Cho in training. I assume you're a med student. Already had your ID checked on the way in. But, you know, the hospital we're building in central Haiti is going to be done on time, more or less. It's going to be a big teaching hospital. So that's part of the answer. The rest of it is you have to inculcate in yourselves a lot of humility and patience, because you're the ones, after all, who are blessed with this kind of medical education. And you're going to go and you're going to be so frustrated sometimes, unless you're made of sterner stuff than I. You know, it can be very frustrating. You know, if you walk by and there's some mess in the floor inside a hospital, or the place smells terrible, but you have to be able to bite your tongue. And there are better ways to get this kind of evening out than going after the pediatrician, say nothing of you'd never go after the patient's mother. Then we've also brought them to Boston and other places. Now a lot of them have MPHs in addition to their MDs or RNs. Some of them are actually doing residency programs. Now remember, if you look at across the whole spectrum, we're the largest employer of Haitian doctors and nurses, and we're working in the public sector as much as we can, which is to say all the hospitals are public sector hospitals. But only 10% of them have ever had a residency. So they've come right out of med school, and then they get thrown into some, you know, backwater clinic somewhere in rural Haiti, not in a Partners in Health sister site. That's a really debilitating year. And so try to keep that stuff in your mind when you do this. And some of my most passionate students from Harvard have not always been patient enough, and it's always come back to bite them. And then they have to retreat, and they get burned, and they retreat, and then they go back. Whereas if we could get better at inculcating that patience and humility early on, it would probably make for easier relations. Because this is what you're describing. We're rich. It's nothing to do with West and East. It's about rich and poor, right? You can't say Haiti's not a Western nation. It's the most Western nation in the hemisphere. It's like the ultimate Western nation. None of the people who live there are there still. It's all post-colonial, post-slavery. It's very Western, but it's very poor. And, you know, you could go back to Rwanda, which is not a Western nation, but their problems are mostly the ones I've described in Haiti: poor infrastructure, great poverty. They have a more organized approach to it. But again, it's still this process of bringing together and not lowering our standards, but trying to help other people raise theirs. Thank you. Yeah.
Michael McLaughlin, I'm a med student also. This kind of relates to the answer you gave to the last question.
The Fiji water is better, I think. That extra $60 zillion is... Go ahead. Sorry, Mike.
I was wondering, when you put so much emphasis on working really closely with the local community, and a lot of these places that you're working have big problems with corruption and that sort of thing, how does that affect your work?
And yeah.
What sort of methods do you use?
Yeah, I mean, again, these are, you guys are asking all the, can't you ask something simple like, name the four plasmodia that caused malaria, or how would you treat canicular fever? Anyway, you know, I sometimes bite my tongue on this one too, this question, because I get asked it a lot, not in the temperate way that you ask it, but in a different way, with a sort of, you know, you're asking because you really want to find out what I have to say about this. But 52% of the time I'm asked the question, about 52.6, it's not, they're not really asking a question. They're doing this, they're saying, well, how can you do this kind of work where there's so much corruption? That's the way it gets asked more often, not how would you deal with this? And then this in question, you know, the tongue biting goes on when I think about, I mean, we've created a whole new kind of corruption here in the United States, like Enron, and it's stunning, the industrial strength corruption. And everybody knows that there's no corruption in Iowa. People are just too kind, gentle, open, and Midwestern. But on the coasts, no, I'm just saying, you know, sometimes sometimes people, you know, when they're asking that, they forget that they're conflating corruption and poverty. Now, corruption is endemic in poor countries. So why am I saying conflating? Because a lot of it is tied to the lack of an infrastructure of transparency, right? So what does it require to not have corruption? You need basically electricity, spreadsheets, computers, of course, spreadsheets, bookkeepers, people who know, anybody here an anthropologist or a sociologist, or are there any, you're sort of timidly saying, kinda, but interested in social sciences. You know, there's a book called Audit Culture by an anthropologist named Madeline Strathern. I think that's right. And audit culture is just that. It is what we think of as transparency is really a seal of approval from people who master audit culture. And that would be KPMG. And, you know, Arthur Andersen was Enron's accountant. And Enron, and what they did there, I think, brought that company down, the audit culture company. Does anybody know? I mean, I'm just a layperson. Isn't that right?
Crashed, yeah.
Yeah. So that kind of industrial strength corruption, when it gets laid out like a Ponzi scheme, or I'm not saying Enron was a Ponzi scheme, but it you know, trading short and trading. I don't know what any of that stuff means, but I'm just saying the cultural outlines I can identify as an anthropologist. And then I find out colleagues in the social sciences have written whole books about this. So back to the pragmatics, how would you deal with that? What we've tried to do is to train local people, you know, and by that, it may just means they're Rwandans or Haitians or Peruvians. They don't come from some little village necessarily. They've learned how to read and write. Some of them are accountants. And you know, it's a degree that it's not that difficult to get in parts of the third world, believe it or not. And then we try to put in the infrastructure of transparency. So again, the electricity, because the places we go when we start, there often isn't electricity. Computers, spreadsheets, and then we can import some of our capacity from Boston, like the finance team, the management team. They do a lot, they do an enormous amount of technical assistance to our partner organizations. Now, I'm sure I don't thank them publicly enough, Emily. Note to self, thank audit culture people at Partners in Health. And when you have a good country like Rwanda, where it's the part of their national ethos is to build this platform of transparency, of course your work is that much easier. Because you don't have to play the bookkeeper or the accountant or the assessor of audit culture. They have their own people doing that. And they also are willing to learn. But in other places, you're going to find either you're working against the grain. I was talking with Mary about Mozambique. I've certainly worked in places where it would be very difficult to introduce and grow and nurture and grow audit culture in the good way, not in the Enron way. And you know, that's what we're trying to do, is trying to do a grassroots level up. Now, maybe we've grown too quickly, actually, and are managing too much money now. It wouldn't surprise me if that were the assessment of a professional audit firm. But again, I have a limited amount of respect for the professional firms, because they were willing, after all, to give their seal of approval to enterprises that were fraudulent, but well-resourced. And so what we're saying is, help us, and you don't have to just give your seal of approval, but help us give credibility to non-fraudulent activities that are under-resourced. And sometimes that appeal works, and sometimes it doesn't, meaning to the audit people. You know, I could give you a chapter and verse about that, but it'll end up on, you know, Twitter this or Twitter that. But that's how we do it. We try to say, we know we need expertise, just like you don't want me doing your neurosurgical procedure, you don't want me doing the books. You know, they don't know how to do that. There are people who know how to do that. Bring them in to help and make sure they share their capacity with the people that they're working with. You'd be amazed how many villagers can, you know, master a spreadsheet in 2 days. Maybe you wouldn't be amazed. Maybe you already know. But there are people in every country in which I've worked, everyone without exception. Obviously, the places like Russia and the United States, we work in the United States, and Peru is not so difficult. But every poor country we've worked in, you also found people who are just whizzes at this kind of stuff, if you can find them and work with them. Somebody over here, yes, you were going to say.
Hi.
And then behind you. What's your name? No, you first. I decide. I'm the decider, remember? Oh, and that was the president.
I also met a student. And I guess building kind of off of that, when you enter a new place for the first time and you're trying to establish some intervention, just like research or anything, have you met any of the obstacles such as distrust from the local government, and how do you overcome that?
Yeah, sure. We've met distrust. I just had this experience. I wish you'd been there. It was really cool, Emily. Back to Dr. Cho's question. You know, my answer was about humility and patience. There's always a way to work with local officials. Now, you don't want to work with some genocidal regime, but you said local. How many local officials are the authors of really bad, evil endeavors? Not that many. They get caught up in the machinery, as they did in Rwanda prior to the genocide. And I don't think we could have done public health in those circumstances. I know we couldn't have worked in Rwanda to have an ambitious program like the one we have now. That's a post-genocide project. And I've worked in other places, which I don't like to name them by name, because we're still working on those places. But I work in places. If you made a graph in your mind's eye, and at the top are the governments, local and national, that are most committed to working on investing in health and education, and back to Jeffrey's question, breaking the cycle of poverty and disease, you could up there be some up here committed to transparency, good governance. Maybe they're tough, like the Rwandans. They're tough on all of us. But their commitment is to breaking that cycle of poverty and disease, right? And on the other end, you see governments that are either they don't have the audit capacity, or they don't have the will to move in that direction. I've seen them all. And I've found ways, or we, because I'll say it means we, because I've never done any project on my own except for writing. But none of the program stuff, it's always been with teams. We have found ways to work with all of those types of governments. Or not government. There are a couple of exceptions where we were in such opposition, you know, the people we were working with, the community health workers. And in northern Guatemala, for example, a place where we worked since the late 80s, a colleague of mine, who you know also, Chris Hagenhogen, wrote a paper in 1981, I think, called Will Primary Healthcare Be Allowed to Succeed? And he, in looking up the community health workers that he and others had helped to train, more than half of them had been killed by the army directly. So, you know, the opportunities for doing robust public health work in that kind of setting are fairly limited. But there's always a way to work with local communities. And, you know, the ideal is to work with the local governments. And Last point on that is if you don't work with governments at all, which is what's happening in Haiti, then you know, you're really never going to get towards basic rights to health care or education, nor, you know, will you ever break that cycle of poverty and disease. I shouldn't say nor will you ever. It's very difficult to do that. I mean, Chile, I mean, you could go case by case and say, look at all these countries where they've had authoritarian regimes and still grown. And I'm not having that debate. I'm saying for public health, you need the public sector, and you don't want them to be a bunch of cads and layabouts and worse. But there's usually a way. On the way here, in plane number 17, our colleagues sent us a review of this earthquake book in today's Foreign Affairs by an economist named Paul Collier. And I didn't get through it all because it said, click here to show more, and then the flight attendants say, we told you to turn your handheld device off. But it's a pretty honest discussion of the struggle between investing in poor governments to make them better and doing it on your own, which a lot of us end up doing, which is unfortunate for Haiti, because that cycle can't be stopped unless the NGOs and universities, and you know, you guys are in a medical school, find some way to add up to greater, more than the sum of their parts, and maybe even strengthen local government. It's very hard to do. Please make it be an easy question this time.
So I hear you talking a lot. I'm going to focus on one question, and I'll kind of wrap up short and brief. But it sounds like you deal with a lot of big problems of like this paternalistic point of view that rich countries have towards poor, and then extensive medicine that, you know, a lot of medical practitioners have towards disadvantaged and poor. And for you, what has been the biggest obstacle when it comes to dealing with this paternalistic attitude?
Well, I think sometimes paternalism has a bad rap, okay? Because it has almost only negative connotations now as a word, but it does mean fatherly, right? And I think you and all of us who are doctors and clinicians will benefit from a kind of symbolic legitimacy as people who are openly acknowledging that some of us are well and some of us are sick, and that we can find ways and have found ways over the years to acknowledge that difference and still have a way of interacting meaningfully with people who are often, in the kind of work I do, are marginalized by not just illness, but poverty, gender inequality, racism. So think of another profession where it would be as easy as it is for us to span those worlds. And, you know, I'm very grateful for that. I don't know what year are you?
I'm just starting.
So I think as you spend more time in the wards and then onward in internship, residency, and I've already chosen a fellowship for you, as you move on, I think you'll feel that, as I did more and more, that it's not that paternalism is okay. It's just that we are privileged. I mean, I think this is the point you are. We are very privileged, and there's a certain kind of disparity that is built into your life now. You're the doctor. Do you have any idea what kind of medicine you're going to do? I mean, it's early, but you're the doctor, you know, and there's somebody else who's the patient, and there's the family member of the patient, and there are ways of bringing respect and equity and affection and into the equation that can complement your expertise. And anybody, you know, back to your point about chronic disease, anytime you're working with patients with chronic illness, you'll also get to know them very, very well, you know, and their families. I mean, that's ideal. So dealing with paternalism, I just want to say that there's some kinds of disparities that are built into our lives, which we, you know, I mean, for example, maybe I'm wrong, but I'm always calling patients, especially younger ones, petit moi. You know, and they come right in, it's my child, and they come right in and they call me, I mean, sometimes they'll call me petit moi, you know, or it's an age thing in Haiti. And, you know, I think there's sometimes too studied an informality to this, whereas there are legitimate forms of informality that are, they're not paternalistic, but they are acknowledging that you're the doctor, and that's been, don't be too shy of that, because sometimes that's just what patients want, is they want, they're sick, they want someone to take care of them. And it's going to be you and a team. It's not the doctor. It's the doctor and the nurse and the social worker and the pharmacist, whatever. But I think that, I don't know, we need to rehabilitate that a little bit in medicine and say it's not such a bad thing. Paternalism in aid, I'll tell you what I've come up with, and I'm just kind of trying this out for the first time. I like your, you know, I hope it's going to fly, but there's this term that we kind of stole from theology, which is not a place that I shop for lots of stuff. It's too arcane. But this term accompaniment, you know, as opposed to, you look at the way foreign aid is done, it's very paternalistic. And that's true of the multilaterals, and I have no idea what these things were 10 or 15 years ago. Multilaterals would be groups like the World Bank, the IMF. They're not just bilateral, United States, Haiti, or France, Rwanda. And they're struggling because they don't have alternative paradigms, in part for the reasons that you mentioned, that there's rich countries, poor countries, post-colonial, yada, yada. And there's a long list. And I think that the notion of accompaniment, of walking, I mean, so if you look it up, if you're nerdy enough to do this, you'll find that it comes from Latin, ad companis, breaking, you know, eating with someone. I always thought it meant walking together. Either way, it's about a symbolically egalitarian endeavor, right? I think it's an idea with some legs. Now, what would that look like in terms of programmatic stuff? You know, if you were in Mozambique, what would it look like to have an accompaniment-inspired project in, let's just say, in primary healthcare? Well, it would involve some things like, well, make sure you hire people locally. You don't have high overheads in your project, like 50% overhead, too high. What about local procurement? You don't want to procure vaccines locally in Mozambique. But what about food for the hospitals? Or what about the food that you're complementing the care package for wasting disease, the med pack? There's just all kinds of things that you could do, I think. And we're trying to lay those out. It's kind of boring, in a boring arena. It's not anywhere near as exciting as, say, osteomyelitis. But we got to figure some of this stuff out. In fact, this back to the three or four questions really have from the first one to the penultimate one, I think, are really, that's part of the answer, is find ways to accompany people. How did that go, by the way? Thumbs up? This is my first, well, I have second accompaniment talk, comment. Yes?
My name is Emily.
Hey, Emily.
So you talked about some really interesting principles, you know, global health equity and things that we might view as sort of like a long-term goal.
Yeah.
From the perspective of an individual who's interested and passionate about trying to move in that direction, do you think that, well, what do you think of the relative virtues of sort of this, like, overarching what's wrong with the system that's preventing, you know, this kind of health care, and what is a holistic approach to fixing it versus the sort of micro level, maybe like the cleft palate oriented approach? Like, one thing we can do well, and we're going to go do it for a bunch of people.
Well, I think it's critical that we not allow ourselves to be dragged in to what's happening a lot in healthcare economics and debates around global health, which is to say, how do we choose between A or B? So between cleft palate repair and primary healthcare, because that's basically, once they win that, and I'm not in too much of a rush, by the way. Okay, don't try to. I came all the way 17 flights to see them. Don't drag me away from that. You know, if that's how the terms of the debate are set, we clinicians lose. We can't win, right? We have to say, well, wait, are you sure that the cleft palate repair can't be used to strengthen the health system that would allow us to treat obstructed labor, which is the ranking cause of young women's death in this region, and is a surgical problem? You know, so I think that requires your generation of people who have, you know, limited amounts of time outside of these medical centers, you know, back to your point, but have had a taste of really, you know, not a great healthcare system. I don't think we have a great healthcare system. We have great health centers, though, and great academic, probably have I'm sure we have the best academic medical centers anywhere in the world. Right, we might not have a great healthcare system as a nation, we got great health academic medical centers. So your views, which have not been solicited in the past, no global health policy or international health policy has ever really reached out to academic medicine and said, hey, what do you guys think? So you basically, we have not been involved in these debates. We should be involved in the debates and have equity as a goal, which means that we're not saying our goal is not to treat cleft palate. Our goal is to treat cleft palate, you know, and every malignancy and whatever ails people, basically. That's our goal, is to roll out an equity program. The way we get there is going to be a million different ways. You know, we can't impose one way on doing that. It won't work. I just heard from Mary that when she was in Mozambique, they would use Partners in Health materials for their project. That's why we posted it. We don't have any chance of influencing global policy debates without having groups saying, hey, we've done this and it works. It's not just them. We did this here in another country, another place, another setting. We did this in, you know, rural Siberia. We did this. So when I say that's going to be your generation's, you know, challenge, I really mean it. I think it's going to be a lot of work for you guys to master the concepts. It's a lot of work. I find it a lot of work to master the concepts of these debates and have something to contribute to them forcefully. Right now, what I think is happening to academic medicine and to clinical medicine and to subspecialty medicine is they're basically making us be quiet. They being, you know, I sound like some conspiracy theorists. There are a lot of those in your country. But, you know, health economists really control a lot of the debate. And, you know, that's fine. We need them, you know, for the reasons that I offered in responding to your question. We desperately need them. We should have hired more and worked with more of them in the past. But we also have something to add, right, as doctors, nurses, or family members of patients, or patients. Anyway, that's another long answer to it. But I really think we have to change the terms of the debate a little bit or wrestle them back to us. Yeah.
My question's a little bit more domestic. I'm Alan, by the way. I was just curious what your experience has been for since Massachusetts has implemented their healthcare system or their health insurance system, like how it was before, how it is now, what changes took place, like maybe what were some obstacles for medical providers to overcome,
yeah,
and what we might maybe be able to.
Yeah. Well, you know, I first of all, let me confess that an academic, you know, clinician is somewhat shielded from those changes. And that's true here in Iowa City as well. That is, especially in subspecialty medicine like infectious disease. But that's not an answer to the question. What I will say in terms of programs is that, because you said domestic, and I wanted to say, remember, equity isn't really about a national border. So the kind of work that I'll describe, well, I don't know how much chance I'll have to describe tonight, but using community health workers and relying on them as your partners, you know, to deliver care. We did that in Massachusetts too, right? Because it really is about, back to the question of chronicity, it's really about chronic versus acute. So the model that we developed in Haiti to take care of HIV disease and tuberculosis is the same model that's desperately needed in Boston for other chronic diseases. And, oh gosh, it's needed in Siberia. Oh, in Moscow and Rwanda. It's needed everywhere. Basically, better management, outpatient, in fact, in the home management, not the medical home. You know, what is a medical home? I foolishly thought in 2008, I thought it meant, oh, great, home-based care. It doesn't mean that. It's still outside the home. Yeah. It's called medical home. It's a very cautious profession. It's getting more bold, but our profession. Is you a med student also?
Yeah.
So even the medical home didn't mean the medical home. What we're saying is, wait, we need to find a way to compensate the community health workers, you know, here in Boston. And the insurers ought to be part of that. And the state and local government, part of that. So it has still been a big hassle, even within an environment that is, I think, pretty forward-thinking. And I know the people, you know, running the show. And I just got asked today, again, a lot of things happening on that plane, too. Cedar Rapids. I got asked today to sign a petition about some directed to the ranking health officer in Massachusetts, and it's a personal friend of mine, as you might imagine. I'm still going to sign the petition. But it's not because we lack smart people or goodwill. The systems are not set up. What do they call this in economics? Misaligned incentives, right? I mean, if you can't reimburse low-cost, high-yield community health workers, and it's because of the insurance system and not because of the fact the outcomes are... even if you follow, forget about mortality. Well, don't really forget about it. But if you just follow recurrent admissions to an emergency room, the ones who get community-based care don't go back to the emergency room, just like in Haiti and Rwanda. And I'm not just talking about HIV. I'm talking about chronic disease. You get, you know, good management of diabetes, you know, you won't be in the ER all the time or the OR. So that makes no sense. It's not a sensible program. We have to fix it. And, you know, someone said to me today, again, it's a very busy entrance into Cedar Rapids in Iowa City, is that one of the things he liked about Iowa, this is a guy from Iowa, so he's possibly praising himself, was that people do have this kind of can-do attitude. And that's really important for this question, you know, domestically, as you said. Because it's not about the money only. We're spending more money than any other country on the face of this earth. Not just absolute dollars, that too, but GDP, you know, as a fraction of our GDP. And so we're putting our treasure, and I think our best minds on this. I mean, I must say, I've been teaching med school for 20 years. The crop that's coming in is fantastic. Idealistic, smart, good at academics, kind to people, thoughtfully chosen by their med schools. So I'm full of optimism about the caliber and the resources domestically. It's got to be the systems that get reconfigured. And unfortunately, again, back to this point I made to Emily, we have to be part of that debate. I mean, we don't want that to all be decided by others who are not healthcare providers. We want to have a big voice in that. In the past, if you look back 50 years ago, the American professional lobbies in medicine were really just looking out for the doctors. It's not a good way to be a lobbyist as a doctor, I believe. I think it's a lot more powerful to be lobbyists for better care and better health systems, and not just for what we're compensated. It's a stupid way to proceed as a professional lobby. And, you know, if we were, you know, I think it's probably stupid for the oil industry too, but I was going to pick on them for a second. No offense to any of you who may be. I wouldn't say that in Texas. Can I just do like 17 more real quick? Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to The Short Code. The Short Code is produced by the Writing and Humanities Program at the University of Iowa Carver College of Medicine, with support from Medical Student Government. You can visit us online at theshortcode.com, you can find us on Facebook, and you can follow us on Twitter, where we're known as The Short Code. We also take comments and story ideas and the occasional rant from you, our listeners, via email at theshortcoats@gmail.com. Or leave us a message at 347-SHORT-CT. That's 347-746-7828. That's also where you can submit a question for our advice segment, The Short Couch. The executive producers are Jason T. Lewis and David T. Etler. Our theme music is by Revolution Void from the album Increase the Dosage. Find them at www.revolutionvoid.com.